The primaries in Puerto Rico led to chaos at the polls.
I've spoken to several legal experts who say this is unprecedented. So the law doesn't really address this. You know, there's a lot of gray area.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 11th, a look at why there were missing ballots at the Puerto Rican primaries. Also, public health officials around the country are being threatened and attacked in response to their policies to combat coronavirus.
Across the country, we've seen health officers subject to doxing, the exposure of their personal information like their addresses or loved ones' names on the internet, angry and sometimes armed protesters showing up at their private residences, and even death threats to the point of having to have private security details assigned to their families.
And how the pandemic has affected the mental health of healthcare workers.
We're already burnt out, but facing the prospect of 6 months to another year of this is daunting.
But first, a look at the crisis in Lebanon after the explosion in Beirut and how Lebanese Americans are responding. Last week in Beirut, thousands of tons of ammonium nitrate exploded in the city's port. At least 150 people were killed, more than 5,000 were injured, and more than 300,000 people lost their homes. For a country that had already been experiencing a devastating economic crisis, the explosion has only worsened conditions in Lebanon.
All the Lebanese I know want to leave and wanted to leave before this crisis. And, you know, if you've lost everything you have, there's no money or option of rebuilding. I think a lot of people are looking to leave the country at the moment, and that's another tragedy because it's a brain drain and it's a drain of talent and people from this country.
That was Liz Sly, Beirut bureau chief for the Washington Post. In response to the explosion, thousands of Lebanese took to the streets, clashing with security forces. And on Monday, top officials from the Lebanese state resigned, including the prime minister. The situation has many people around the world, particularly those from Lebanon, watching to see what happens next in their country. Sulame Anderson is a Lebanese-American journalist and the author of The Hostage's Daughter, A Story of Family, Madness, and the Middle East. And she's been watching the situation in Lebanon unfold from Canada. Sulame, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what have you been hearing from family who are living in Lebanon? Are they okay?
They're all safe, thank God. But the situation, I mean, it's been deteriorating for some time. There's a level of hopelessness. Where my house is about 15 miles away from Beirut, and our windows were blown in. That's how powerful the blast was. So thank God my family is safe. But, you know, the situation is such that they're just despondent.
We're talking about the Lebanese diaspora watching this from outside of the country, and I'm wondering how are people responding that you're in touch with in terms of folks who are seeing this unfold?
I mean, there's a helplessness that really can't be explained. Everybody watching it from outside is just, it's like watching a train wreck in slow motion, except everyone you love is on the train. It's really horrific, and I think the strange part about it is there's a sense of guilt that, at least for me, that I'm not there. I should be there. I should be witnessing this. And maybe that has something to do with me being a journalist. But at the same time, I think a lot of Lebanese outside of Lebanon feel that like they should be there helping in some way or protesting or, you know, with their families. And there's this impotence that's really, really difficult for all of us.
We heard that there have been top officials who have resigned, including a couple of ministers. As you see their resignations, where do you think that leaves Lebanon right now?
I mean, to be honest, this is not the first time the government has resigned. Where it leaves Lebanon, it might just be in the same place that it has been before. The problem with this government is that even if the government resigns, the likelihood of them bringing in new blood is, you know, people who are really going to institute reforms is extremely slim. Chances are this government will just be reshuffled. The same players will, you know, reappear again, or maybe people who are serving as proxies for those players that are completely responsible for the state that Lebanon is in and the Beirut blast. So it's really hard to say the chances of anything really changing in a substantive way. I wish I had more hope for that, but.
You've been aware of conflict in Lebanon since the time you were born. Your father, Terry Anderson, had a big role in your understanding of that. Tell us about him.
So both my parents, my father was the Beirut bureau chief for the Associated Press, and my mother was a reporter with ABC and a fixer. So both of my parents covered the Civil War, and my father was kidnapped 3 months before I was born, and he was released almost 7 years later. So I grew up just surrounded by war and Lebanese conflict, and I remember seeing the first time in my life seeing the aftermath of an explosion. I think I was like 2 or 3 in footage, but I was in and out of Lebanon during the war as well. I was in shellings. I remember the tension and the sound of gunfire, and I never saw the actual worst of it as a child, thank God, in person, but I was just surrounded by it constantly. My parents' friends were journalists covering that, and knowing my father was imprisoned there throughout my whole childhood really shaped my understanding of the country.
There are now protests taking place in Lebanon, and they're calling for the end of the current regime. Tell us what you're seeing as far as the protests as they're unfolding. Lebanon has historically had conflict, but is this different from what you've seen in the past?
I mean, the level of rage is much higher than I think it's ever been, but Lebanon has been protesting for some time. The Lebanese people have been in the streets on and off for a few years now, starting with the garbage crisis when basically, to make a long story short, the leaders of Lebanon were too busy arguing with each other over who got the biggest cut of the garbage disposal, the waste disposal process. So they didn't pick up the trash in Beirut for, almost a year. And it was a nightmare. So the rage at the government, their incompetence, their corruption has been going back some time. And the protests, have been growing and growing in size following the economic collapse, following the complete outrage and horror at the level of mismanagement, the level of corruption that's going on in the government. So it's going to grow in size, and the rage is going to grow. The issue is what's going to happen? What can anyone do to change the situation? I'm not sure what the answer to that is. If this is different from other times, it's different from other times because it's just, we've been brought to the point where we have nothing left as a country, in terms of a state. There's literally nothing. The state, the government, is responsible for the deaths of, over 200 Lebanese and displacement. People are angry. People are furious. But the issue is what happens next? Is there a plan? Let's say the government, after the government resigns,
Though, where are they pointing the finger right now?
Well, at the entire structure, ruling structure of Lebanon. This is what I would call a mafia government. These people are warlords. Most of them have been around since the Civil War. Some of them are literally war criminals, and they have been running Lebanon like their personal con, their Ponzi scheme, for way too long now, and people are pointing the finger at them because look what happened. These explosives were left in the center of the city for over 6 years. What kind of government is so inept and incompetent that they can't dispose of explosives in the middle of their city? I mean, that's the lowest you can go.
What about the international response, Sulaimeh, to what's happening in Lebanon? Would you say that it's been sufficient, or has international powers really contributed to what we're seeing right now?
Well, I mean, international powers can't be blamed for the blast. That's really something that the Lebanese government, that's the blame. Let's say even if, like some people are saying, someone else set off the explosion, no one else kept those explosives there for 6 years. So there's really nowhere else to blame. But as far as the international response to Lebanon, I mean, foreign countries have been meddling in Lebanon for before it was even a country. You have France and England, some time ago. And now, in recent years, you have, Syria, Israel, America to some extent, Saudi Arabia, Iran. These are all countries that have interests in Lebanon and have been kind of in some way influencing affairs there. So there is a legacy of foreign interference in Lebanon that has led to the place that it is now in terms of vulnerability, instability of the state. Yes, there is a role in that, but as far as this goes, no, this is squarely on the backs of the Lebanese government.
Is there concern that this could lead to a bigger conflict in Lebanon, particularly between Hezbollah and Israel?
I mean, the threat of another war with Israel has been hanging over Lebanon for a long, long time now. I would say maybe that's not such a concern at this moment, but the possibility of instability is already unstable. It's kind of a miracle that hasn't exploded into some larger conflict yet. And the fact of the matter is, if Lebanon falls into a conflict, let's say between Hezbollah or Israel, or a civil war, or God forbid any of these things, this is not something that will be contained to one country. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, from my perspective, stability in Lebanon is the glue that holds the entire Levant together, because, you know, you have Syria next door, you have Israel on the other side. You know, there is so, it's like just a bonfire soaked in gasoline waiting for a match. Hopefully things straighten out there, but the situation is very concerning, and it should be concerning for Americans too, because we have interests there, and our interests don't lie in the entire region, you know, going up in flames.
Do you see a solution for Lebanese people to get the justice that they deserve right now?
Well, I think Lebanese people, the only chance they have of anything changing is if they completely reject sectarianism and the forces that have exploited their differences and their sectarianism for their own purposes. So if the Lebanese, you know, sort of turn away from that, stand together, demand certain things, you know, stay in the streets, but united, that is the key. The Lebanese people have to be united for maybe the first time in their history. They have to stand together and just say, enough. We are together. During the protests recently, there was an expression, killon yani killon, which means all of them is all of them. So that means the government, there's no choosing favorites. There's no, we side with this party, we side with this sect. No, the entire country, all the Lebanese people have to stand together now and rebuild their country if they have any chance of survival of this country that is really a very special place. I mean, the whole world is watching what's happening in Lebanon, and there's a poignancy to it because most people, especially people of a certain age, remember Lebanon the way it used to be. It was like, wow, you know, the Paris of the Middle East, Beirut was. It was a sophisticated place, and you know, to know what it used to be and to see what's happening now, I think it's breaking a lot of people's hearts all over the world.
Zulameh Anderson is a Lebanese-American journalist and author of The Hostage's Daughter, A Story of Family, Madness, and the Middle East. Zulameh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Puerto Rico can't seem to catch a break. On Sunday, the island's election commission had to partially suspend its primaries due to unprecedented chaos at the polls. According to the Associated Press, about half of the island's 110 voting centers did not receive ballots or received them hours late. This comes just 1 year after political turmoil rocked the island, and also amid its ongoing recovery from Hurricane Maria, a devastating financial crisis, and a spate of earthquakes earlier this year. And don't forget, Puerto Rico, like much of the world, is also still in the thick of responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining me now is Danica Cotto, correspondent for the Associated Press covering the Caribbean. Danica, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why weren't there ballots at these voting centers? What happened?
Well, the president of the Elections Commission gives several reasons, including the pandemic, Tropical Storm Isaias, which occurred a week before the primaries were held, and a last-minute request from the island's two main parties for more than 75,000 additional ballots. In addition, other officials say that the suppliers asked for payment up front in a first-of-its-kind request. What went wrong depends on who you ask. The last of the remaining ballots did not arrive until after 8 p.m. on Saturday, August 8th, when they were supposed to arrive on August 5th. Then the trucks that they rent, to take briefcases containing the ballots and electronic voting machines to these centers across the island did not go out until Sunday, the day of the primary, when normally they leave 1 or 2 days before an election.
The Election Commission has suspended the primary until next Sunday, August 16th. Does that apply to all the precincts or just where there weren't enough ballots at the time? Like, or does everyone have to start again here?
No, right now the plan is, like you said, hold part of the primary, or the remaining primary rather, on August 16th for those precincts where voting never took place. So these are the centers that, because they either never received the ballots or they received them too late for them to hold voting, that they just never opened. This, of course, raises a question of what happens to voters whose centers eventually received the ballots, held the voting, but these voters were not able to return because of the work, because they were working, or because they simply didn't realize that the ballots had arrived.
After Sunday's chaos, Governor Wanda Vasquez and other officials are calling for the resignation of Juan Ernesto Davila, who's the president of the Election Commission. What did the Election Commission say?
Well, the president did not face the public or the media for the entire day. On Sunday, he granted only two interviews to a radio station and a TV station. And many, you know, were demanding that he make some sort of statement, that he explain what was going on. Of course, that led to a lot of frustration, a lot of anger. Then on Monday, he talked to more people, and he said that he does not feel it's responsible to step down right now. Keep in mind that the governor has asked for his resignation and other top officials as well. He said once the primary is over, he will consider and analyze that request.
Let's even give our listeners some background here, because the candidates who are participating in the primaries are from two of the major Puerto Rican parties, the Popular Democratic Party and the New Progressive Party, which is the party that's currently in power. Who is running for this election? Who are the key figures that we need to keep an eye on?
So there's several key figures. There's two people running for the pro-statehood New Progressive Party, which is the governor's party. And of course, it's the governor running against Pedro Pierluisi. He's a seasoned politician. He represented Puerto Rico in Congress from 2009 to 2017. Now, both the governor and Pierluisi, they have both served as governors after the previous governor, Ricardo Rosselló, stepped down following huge protests in August 2019. At the time, Pierluisi served less than a week as governor after the island Supreme Court ruled that the current governor, who was at the time the justice secretary, that she was constitutionally next in line because there was no secretary of state at the time.
And we're talking about Wanda Vasquez, who initially said she didn't want the role and then accepted the role.
Correct. She accepted the role. And even after she accepted the role, she said, I'm not interested in running. And, you know, now she is running. Now, moving on to the Popular Democratic Party, that's the main opposition party of the island. It supports the island's current political status as a U.S. territory. And this primary is the first one it's holding in its for the first time in its 82-year history. So there's three people running, you know, to become the nominee for that party. The first one is pretty well known. She's San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz. She's known for her public spats with President Donald Trump, especially after Hurricane Maria. The second candidate is a longtime Senator Eduardo Batia. And the third candidate is Carlos Delgado, who is the mayor of the northwest coastal town of Isabela.
What's the historical precedent for this, Danica? I mean, is this the first time we've seen this type of electoral madness in Puerto Rico?
It is. It's the first time that this happens in Puerto Rico. And that's why it's taken so many people aback. I mean, things were bad on this island, but it had not reached this level of dysfunction that has proved to be an embarrassment to many. I mean, people are incredulous. I was at one voting center that never opened on Sunday, located in Carolina. And the reaction from voters ranged from, you know, when people told them, no, we're closed, the ballots haven't arrived. They said, I'm sorry, what? What do you mean? I don't understand. Some of them kept lingering around trying to, you know, absorb the information, trying to figure out whether they could return. There was an elderly woman who they gave her a chair, they gave her some food. And keep in mind, you know, Puerto Rico has a lot of elderly people, and many of these people go early in the morning. So, you know, it was the officials said it's outrageous that these centers would be opening around 1, 2, 3 in the afternoon, when elderly people are not going to stand in the blistering sun somewhere open until 10 o'clock at night, which again, you know, it's not an ideal situation, especially given the pandemic. You know, there are people standing in line. Face masks are required, but, you know, there's a lot of sun and people were trying to huddle under the either roofs or trees. So overall, it was just an incredibly chaotic situation.
Danica, does the Puerto Rican Constitution say anything about this? Do we know legally what the next steps are supposed to be?
Actually, it's the electoral law that sort of rules here. And I've spoken to several legal experts who say this is unprecedented. So the law doesn't really address this. You know, there's a lot of gray area. Right now, the future of the primary is basically in the hands of the island Supreme Court. They've agreed to take up four lawsuits. They've combined them. Three of the four lawsuits have been filed by nominees, including Pedro Pierluisi, Carlos Delgado, and Eduardo Batia. And then the fourth lawsuit was filed by a voter. So that ruling could come either on Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday. And depending on that ruling, you know, we'll know whether the primaries will actually be held on Sunday.
Danica, there's also talk about a potential plebiscite on Puerto Rico statehood. This is held once every decade, more or less, where Puerto Ricans get to decide, well, not decide, but they at least get to vote on whether they want to be a state or continue to be a commonwealth or for independence. This is largely symbolic. It doesn't really have teeth, but it's something that's historically taken place. Is that happening this year?
So far, it's supposed to be happening. You know, the way things are going in Puerto Rico, it's kind of hard to say things will happen because it ends up, you know, changing by the minute. This would be the sixth referendum. Again, it's non-binding. That would mean that Congress has to approve it, which is incredibly unlikely. There's a Republican president. The Republicans control the Senate. And for the first time, this referendum will ask a simple yes or no question. Should Puerto Rico immediately be admitted as a U.S. state? Many see it, at least critics do, see it as a ploy of the pro-statehood New Progressive Party to get voters out.
I mean, just know, be clear, that's the only question that's going to be asked?
Correct. That's the only question. And, you know, voter participation is usually high in Puerto Rico, nearly 70%. But again, you know, some see this as a ploy to get more voters out. You know, they'll hold this referendum along with the on the same day of the general elections.
What overall impact, Danica, is this, do you think, going to have on how Puerto Ricans see their government on the island?
I think it's incredibly eroded the trust. Without a doubt, what little trust voters had left in the government is gone. You know, Puerto Rico has prided itself on fair elections, non-controversial, non-chaotic elections. And this is the first time in history of the, you know, the government that this happens. It remains to be seen what impact this will have on voter participation. I spoke to some voters who said, I will absolutely vote. I will stay here all night if I have to. I will go out against on Sunday, August 16th, stay there all day if I have to, while other voters are saying, that's it, I'm done. You know, the government has completely eroded my trust in them. I'm not participating in this anymore. There's a feeling of dismay, disappointment, of what's the point of me voting if nothing's going to change. And so it remains to be seen, you know, what kind of turnout there'll be next Sunday and in November as well.
Danica Cotto is a correspondent for the AP covering the Caribbean. Danica, thanks as always.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do getting death threats for me and my family and harassing my daughters to the point where I have to get security is just, I mean, it's amazing. I wouldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams that people who object to things that are pure public health principles are so set against it and don't like what you and I say, namely in the word of science, that they actually threaten you.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's leading expert on infectious diseases, speaking to CNN's Sanjay Gupta about threats he and his family have received because of his work. And Dr. Fauci is not alone. Public health officials across the U.S. are also receiving threats from people who are against the policies they put forth to combat the coronavirus, things like recommendations to wear masks and practice social distancing. Michelle Mello is a professor of law and a professor of medicine at Stanford, and she's been researching this exact topic. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Michelle, you wrote an article about the attacks on public health officials during COVID-19. What was it that prompted you to even look into this?
Well, it happened that one of my bosses at Stanford is married to our Santa Clara County local health officer here in the Bay Area. So I do have a personal connection to somebody who's experienced these kind of attacks.
Tell us a little bit about what kinds of attacks we're talking about.
Well, across the country, we've really seen a number of things that may to your audience seem pretty shocking and are unusual even in the American context. We have seen, you know, the usual internet trolling, but the attacks have taken on a highly personal and almost violent dimension. Across the country, we've seen health officers subject to doxing, the exposure of their personal information like their addresses or loved ones' names on the internet, angry and sometimes armed protesters showing up at their private residence. Vandalism of their offices and homes, lots of harassing telephone calls, and even death threats to the point of having to have private security details assigned to their families.
Michelle, one of the things that prompted me, I saw the research here and then saw that Dr. Anthony Fauci has needed to get his own extra private security because I believe his family had been threatened. Are we primarily talking about high-profile figures like that, or are we talking about anyone who's sort of on the front lines dealing with coronavirus cases in particular?
Well, we're talking about people who ordinarily are about as low profile as you can get. Local public health is the invisible angel that keeps us all healthy. But most of us until this pandemic never heard of or seen our local health officer. They have been in the news lately on television and the newspaper a lot. So they're no longer such private figures. But these are not high profile figures. They're not national figures in most cases. They're not. They don't have a political agenda. They are doctors trying to do their jobs.
Who are making these threats?
Well, it comes from a variety of quarters. A leader and catalyst in this movement has been the anti-vaccination movement here in the U.S. that has all of a sudden pivoted from their usual agenda of attacking public figures who advocate vaccination to going after health officers who are advocating masking and the extension of stay-at-home or business closure orders. But it's not only these groups. They've been joined by thousands of people across the country who are just really disgruntled and incredibly stressed by the long-term economic impact and social isolation that has stemmed from public health orders during the pandemic.
Medical professionals are take a Hippocratic oath to serve whoever it is that needs their help. And one of the things that's interesting to me about this moment is how unwillingly, I imagine, many medical professionals, nurses and doctors in particular, have been politicized. I imagine this is almost against their own will. Are you seeing that in the circles that you're dealing with, that these folks have, you know, they're really going in to try and save lives? And I mean, I recall images from the earlier on at the peak of the pandemic in certain, you know, cities around the country where doctors and nurses were not only petitioning for better PPE, but also standing, you know, to prevent protesters from accessing hospital areas. So like this feels like doctors and nurses didn't necessarily sign up to be in such a political battle.
You know, it's interesting the politicization of first responders, because those on the front lines who are actually caring for COVID patients have been politicized as heroes in this pandemic. But the same groups of individuals, doctors and nurses who are working in the public health sector, have been demonized as villains. They're all working toward the same goals, and we need to understand that although they execute their objectives in different ways, they're all working towards the same goal, and so are we. So it's really striking to me that there's been this polarization in how folks have viewed first responders and public health doctors.
Have we heard anything from the Trump administration or politicians at any level of government about this? Are there any efforts made to protect medical workers? And I'm asking that because recently here in New York, actually in New Jersey, there was a federal judge whose family was attacked. And now there are talks of increasing protections for federal judges as a result of that, as a result of doxing and personal attacks. I'm wondering if that is now transferring over to the medical professionals and health professionals you're talking about.
Well, again, we have to distinguish between medical professionals who are in the frontline response, like the ones who are working in hospitals, and the ones I'm talking about are those who are working in public health departments. I'm not aware of specific problems involving the folks who are working in hospitals other than nobody wants to stand next to them at the grocery store. But the public health officials really have had to have protection stepped up. Unfortunately, most of our elected officials, to the extent that they're speaking to this issue at all, have been joining in the attacks. You know, there are folks who are making a name for themselves politically by joining in the chorus of attacks against public health officials. In some cases, their own public health officers, you know, saying things like they're anti-democratic, they're tyrannical, when in reality, those same health officers are the only people in that state who can issue these orders. They're executing planning done by other elected officials who then sort of hide behind this rhetoric. So it really is, in my view, despicable that instead of offering support to these hardworking, underpaid, and under attack health officers, state and local officials, and in some cases, congressmen and the president have joined in the attacks. And the president himself has been the fomenter in chief here, retweeting such statements as, everyone is lying. The CDC, media, Democrats, our doctors, everyone we are told to trust. That kind of statement fans the flames.
Michelle, did your research show whether or not there was a difference in health officers who are in red states versus blue states, or are folks that work in these positions across the board subject to this type of harassment?
You know, we really have seen it in all kinds of communities. Certainly, there is a red and blue divide in willingness to accept public health measures like masking. And to the extent that you're leading a community that's more red than blue, you might have a larger segment of the population going after you. But some of the people who have been under attack are in heavily blue communities where actually most of the population really supports what they're doing. Polling is very much in their favor, but there is a vocal extreme, a vocal minority that is dominating attention.
Is there anything that public health officials can do to protect themselves?
You know, to protect themselves, many of them do need security details, and they need elected officials to stand up and indicate that when these actions cross the line into illegal forms of harassment, that they'll be subject to prosecution. In terms of self-defense strategies, you know, I think it may be late in the game for this, but there are some things that I think we know help to cultivate public trust and buy-in to coercive public health legal measures. Polling shows us that when people feel that they have a say in public health policy agendas, when quote unquote people like me can influence agendas in public health policy, they are more likely to accept laws, even the ones that they don't love. So I think there are opportunities for some health officers to double down on the transparency and candor in their public communications. We do have examples of where this has been done extraordinarily well. I think it helps to humanize health officers, to telegraph that they are really struggling with these decisions. They don't take them lightly. And also that they have the support and consultation of a number of other people while they're not acting alone in imposing these orders.
Do you know of any health officers who have decided to leave the job as a result of this? Because it doesn't feel like, you know, the virus is not going away as soon as many of us would have liked, and people are going to have to make policies and implement policies until we've got some clarity on where what the next phase of this is. So have folks that you know decided to leave their jobs as a result?
Absolutely. I think the count is up near 30 now of health officers who have either resigned or been forced out by other elected officials since the start of the disease pandemic because of the politicization of their orders. And that includes Auxerre Barbo, who was the New York City Health Commissioner. It includes Nicole Quick, the health commissioner of Orange County, our most affected county in California in terms of COVID cases. It includes West Virginia health officer for the state, Kathy Slemp. So lots of folks who are dealing very, very difficult situations. Simply, it's just not reasonable to expect them to go on month after month in this kind of climate, especially when they're not getting any support from other officials.
You mentioned Auxides Barbeau, and I know that was a big issue here in New York, particularly because she clashed with Mayor Bill de Blasio. Are we seeing a lot of that as well, just internally among officers and public health officials, and also just, you know, the other officials that they're dealing with? It feels like, I don't know if that was very specific to New York City politics or if that's also happening across the board.
I think that is happening in a lot of communities, yes, where you have a schism between elected branches of government that represent communities that have a particular ideological bent, and health officers who have been serving, you know, for many, many administrations, many, many years, and who are, acting on the science. At this point in the pandemic, people are fed up with the science. They want a balance between health concerns and economic and other concerns. And again, some health officers have been very good at explaining how public health orders balance those concerns, and others who are maybe less transparent really have been confronted by a lot of attacks from elsewhere in government that are, responding to local political pressures themselves.
You mentioned earlier we are having to differentiate between threatening health officers and health officials and threatening frontline workers like doctors and nurses. But are doctors and nurses subject to any type of politicization and threats right now because of the role that what they could possibly represent? Or have they gotten off, have they sort of not been in the crosshairs, if you will?
I'm not aware of those kinds of attacks. I think it's more just that what we hear from them is the difficulty that they have in their personal lives because people know they work with sick people. They don't want to be around them. They don't want to be around their kids. So it's the usual story in any pandemic where if you're the child of somebody who's working with an affected patient, nobody wants their kid in school with you. I think that causes some difficulties for them. But it's a different quality and caliber of attack than what we've been talking about with public health officers.
Michelle Mello is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and a professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The United States is now months into the COVID-19 pandemic with no signs of slowing down. And while healthcare professionals are on the front lines helping patients fight the virus, the battle is taking a mental and physical toll on them as well. A new study shows that during the peak of COVID-19, emergency medicine physicians felt a significant increase in stress and anxiety in their work and their home lives. And we've heard from some of you on how this kind of work is affecting your mental health.
My name is Narisha Fox-Kennard. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I've been a certified nursing assistant since 1999. I usually work a full-time job 6 days a week, but unfortunately with this pandemic and my husband being a cancer survivor, I can no longer do that. I refuse to take the risk of getting him sick with this situation, and sadly, we're suffering for it, but I just mentally can't go out and do something that I know could possibly put him in danger.
I'm Joyce, and I'm calling from Snohomish, Washington. I'm a home care provider, and although I am very careful, my client has a spouse who works full-time with the public. That's why I'm needed. And there are two teenagers living at home. I worry quite a bit that someone will bring COVID into the house and that I will end up carrying it home. My husband is diabetic, and my 87-year-old mother lives with us. I will try not to obsess over it, but I am concerned. We do wash hands often and wear our masks whenever we leave the house. If only I could count on everyone else to do their part.
Thank you for sharing as always. And we're going to talk about it now with Dr. Robert Rodriguez, a UCSF professor of emergency medicine who also works in the emergency department and intensive care unit at San Francisco General. And Dr. Anya Wirtz is an administrative director of the Frontline Workers Counseling Project and a licensed clinical psychologist. I started by asking Dr. Rodriguez whether working in an ER during the pandemic had affected his own mental health.
Without question, I have felt heightened anxiety, a sense of burnout, It's impacted my mental health significantly. On a personal note, had gone to my hometown of Texas, Brownsville, Texas, to help out in a COVID ICU down there in a small community hospital. And that experience was very difficult for me. And coming back from that, have felt considerable just sort of overall shock and anxiety. And I definitely had difficulty sleeping and other issues that the COVID pandemic has clearly affected my health, mental health, and talking to others in similar situations. Overall, it's had a deep impact on the mental health of frontline providers.
Dr. Wirtz, as you listen to Dr. Rodriguez, are you hearing echoes in that in the healthcare workers that you're working with? Are some of the main strains of mental health what Dr. Rodriguez was laying out there?
Yes, I hear a lot of echoes of frontline workers that we've been talking to through the project. There are all kinds of different manifestations of trauma. I think Dr. Rodriguez mentioned some of them, anxiety, but it can also show up as numbness, as deep depression. It has all different kinds of manifestations.
The prognosis right now, we are in a very, we're seeing a high point right now in terms of infection rates. New York City is hovering about 1%. Other parts of the country, Texas, I think is about 17% right now, give or take. This is the best we're looking at. We are hearing from epidemiologists that come the fall, things are going to get worse. And we are being told this may linger for months, if not years. Dr. Rodriguez, does the uncertainty of that timeline add to the stress? This the expectation that if we're already tired and burned out now, this is the level that things are going to be at, if not worse, going forward?
That definitely adds to our stress. In March and April, we were looking at the surge in the pandemic. We all, I guess, maybe somewhat naively thought, okay, well, we can deal with this for a few months, if 6 months if need be. We can just plow through this. But as things go along and as it appears that the pandemic and cases are going to extend through the fall and through the winter, perhaps into next year, it takes a huge toll. We, in the emergency department, we're already burnt out, but facing the prospect of 6 months to another year of this is daunting, and undoubtedly it is adding to everybody's stress.
Dr. Wirtz, when you hear what Dr. Rodriguez is describing, when we think about, just generally speaking, about, you know, right now people are eating at outdoor cafes and trying to make the best of the little time that they have. But the truth is, this is going to be around for a while, as far as we can tell. What are the mental health effects that we can expect to see long-term on healthcare workers right now, provided they stay in the industry?
Well, I think that's one of our major concerns now, because trauma is cumulative. And the longer that this pandemic goes on, the more people are going to start to show signs of post-traumatic stress. So it is very concerning that we don't have a clear endpoint to the pandemic. And as it goes on, it's becoming more and more crucial for people who are in the healthcare field to have mental health support. If you're in a rural community where you are more likely to be burned out because you need to work more, there are also fewer mental health resources in that area. So we really need to make sure that everyone who is in the healthcare field can get help.
Your thoughts on what healthcare workers and other frontline workers can do in addition to seeking mental health services for themselves? Is there anything else they should do or be aware of to help cope in these times?
Well, I think, as both of you noted, you know, healthcare workers and anyone in a helping profession is someone who likes to take care of other people, and they often forget to take care of themselves. So it really is about making sure that you value your own mental health and your own physical health to the same degree that you value others. I mean, one of the challenges we have in outreach is that these are people, as you said, you know, you have doctors in your family, they tend to be stoic, they tend to say they don't need help. So it's really recognizing that there's nothing shameful or weak about needing to take time for yourself and needing to focus on your own needs.
Anya Wirtz is the administrative director of the Frontline Workers Counseling Project, and Dr. Robert Rodriguez is a UCSF professor of emergency medicine who also works in the emergency department and intensive care unit at San Francisco General Hospital. You don't have to be a medical professional to be experiencing mental or physical strain right now. All of us, whether you're a parent trying to homeschool and work a full-time job, a person who lives alone and is fighting isolation, a family wondering when you'll all be able to see each other in person, or just really, really tired of the current state of affairs, I hear you. We hear you on The Takeaway. And that's why we keep on trying to shine a light on these issues. This is a moment where everything feels hard and sometimes even insurmountable. But take solace in knowing that you're not alone. Check in on your neighbors, your friends, your family. Try to stay connected to the small things that bring you joy. Get rest when you can, and please seek professional help if your struggles get too intense. If you or someone you know is in need of mental health treatment, the number for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration's national hotline is 1-800-662-4357. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we're going to get through it, folks. See you tomorrow.